Okay, the first thing I want to say is I'm going to be giving back the exams at the end of the class. And if you have any questions about the exam, you think the grading was inappropriate or whatever, you can see me either after class or during office hours or email me for an appointment or whatever. Let me begin the lecture today by reviewing where we are in the course so far. Okay, this is the second of a two-part lecture dealing with the 1949 to 1954 period. Why is this story important? Well, let me begin by kind of trying to situate it in the context of what we're trying to do in this whole part of the course. We're trying to understand what the Cold War was about, and once we identify what the Cold War is about, you know, it's causing this clash, then we'll be in a position to try and figure out how those tensions were resolved and how a relatively stable international system came into being during the Cold War period. So it's a way of getting at both halves of the problem, you know, what makes for conflict, what makes for war, and also what makes for stable international order. Very interesting story. Right? And how do we get at it? Well, yeah, it's like we look at these different periods when it seemed like a relatively stable system was coming into being. 1945, the Potsdam understandings, you know, completed in the second half of the year by the set of understandings that culminated in the Moscow agreements of December of 1945. And then we looked, yeah, but it didn't work. You have this the Cold War basically breaking out in early 1946. What went wrong, right? So that question kind of focused our attention on what was really important here, what was driving this conflict, right? And then we looked at the set of arrangements that came into being in the spring of 1949, a formal division of Europe into these two blocks. You know, so the West creates its state in Western Germany. Soviets create their state in Eastern Germany. We create a security system for Western Europe, NATO, North Atlantic Treaty Organization. They eventually respond by creating their own security system in Eastern Europe called the Warsaw Pact, right? They seem to accept it. What's the proof that they seem to accept it? Well, their objection to what the West was doing in Western Germany, you know, basically their objection to the policy of creating a West German state without them, and in a sense directed against them, was reflected in the decision to blockade West Berlin, a Western enclave in the middle of communist East Germany. Very effective means of putting pressure on the West. But in the spring of 1949, they abandoned that. Doesn't that suggest that, well, we had tried to prevent it, but we realized we can't do it. We are willing to live with a West German state integrated into the Western system. Right? Formal division of Germany into blocks. Formal division of Europe into blocks. Well, that's the case. You know, where's the problem, right? And yet we know that there is a problem because the world moves into this very great, very deep crisis the following year in the winter of 1950-51. Right? So again, it focuses our attention on this question. What went wrong? Right? And the answer there is, to understand what went wrong, you have to focus on the military side of the story. Right? Because the decision to end the Berlin blockade did not reflect a genuine political acceptance by the Soviet Union of what the Western powers were doing in Western Germany. They accepted it because they were too weak to do anything about it. Right? Why were they too weak? not because they had no military leverage at all, but rather because if war did break out, they might be able in the initial part of the war to overrun all of Western Europe, but there's no way that they could conquer the United States or seriously harm the United States as long as they didn't have any nuclear weapons of their own. The Americans would then gear up, we mobilize, we'd start building bombs and bombers. By that I mean atomic bombs, these are early atomic bombs, and just smash the USSR. It might take a very long time to do that because these early atomic bombs are weapons of relatively limited power. You know, and in the initial atomic attack, we wouldn't be able to do more than bruise the enemy. Right? But in the long run, there was no question about what the outcome of that war would be. You know, you could take your time in fighting it. It's purely one-sided air atomic war. You didn't have to worry about all the problems with mounting an initial atomic attack that you had. You know, 1948-49, limited intelligence, the vulnerability of overseas bases, you know, all that kind of thing. You didn't have to worry about because you had plenty of time because it's going to be a one-sided war. And we saw how the military situation was transformed virtually overnight. When? You can give the exact day. August 29th, 1949. That's the day in which the Soviets exploded their first nuclear device. That's the day in which the American nuclear monopoly is broken. And why were the implications there? Why was this so important? Because it meant we couldn't just take our time and gear up and mount a counteroffensive and so on, because we ourselves would be vulnerable to Soviet attack. They could attack us on one-way missions with the strategic bombers that they had, right? And they knew where all the American bomb production facilities were. They knew where the American air bases were, and so on. Those sorts of things might be able to might enable them to develop the sort of air atomic superiority that could allow them to then go on and smash the general American war-making capability and actually win the war. You know, it's like the American military, people who thought about this stuff, very worried about this kind of thing. I quoted General Bradley telling the National Security Council, November of 1950, if war breaks out now, we might very well lose. We're in danger of losing. And this is a very serious situation for the United States. I have this little diagram here, not to be taken all that seriously, but just to kind of give you a sense for how the military balance was shifting in the first 15 years or so of the post-war period. Right? 1945, at the end of the war, the United States is by far the strongest country in the world, right? Just in terms of industrial potential, where it's at the peak of its power, greater than it ever had been in the past, and greater than it ever would be in the future. America has a nuclear monopoly. America has a very well-trained military force, an army, honed to a peak of very efficient fighting ability, it's a very strong navy, strong air force. Right? We tear it up basically as soon as the victory is won. We go down to these kind of low military spending policies. It's not full speed ahead in terms of building up an atomic arsenal or building up an air force that could launch a nuclear strike. Relatively limited. We don't develop the intelligence capabilities we would need to support a nuclear strategy. Right? That's the story in the 1940s. Why is this important? Because if war breaks out, the United States will not be able to win at the very outset of the war. We would not be able to prevent the Soviets from overrunning Western Europe. We'd win in the end, but in the process, Western Europe would be destroyed, especially our friends in Western Europe. We can't take a tough line because if we do, it's going to scare the living daylights out of our European friends. You know, they certainly would not look forward to the prospect of, you know, being liberated as ruins 5 to 10 years down the road, not least because in the event of this kind of long war, 5 to 10 year war, the Americans would have to destroy the military economic infrastructure of Western Europe with atomic attacks. This, we're held back, right? Even though we'd win in the long run, we're held back because a victory would be a Pyrrhic victory. You know, that gives the Soviets a certain room for maneuver. But a limited room for maneuver, because the last thing they want is an all-out war that they would lose in the end, no matter what sorts of initial victories they would be able to run up. So that's the situation here in the late 40s, you know, 47, 48, 49. Precarious balance. Two sides, you know, neither of them really has the upper hand, or neither side can impose its will because of the military situation. And like I say, that changes virtually overnight with the breaking of the American nuclear monopoly, because all these problems that didn't matter much in the era of the American nuclear monopoly now matter a great deal, right? If, you know, now that the Soviets have atomic bombs, our ability to mount an attack from overseas bases, especially bases in the British Isles, very problematic. You know, they can neutralize those bases. And then what that means is if you can't mount a sustained attack with these medium bombers going back and forth, and you have to rely on the handful of transcontinental bombers that we had, you know, these B-36 bombers, you wouldn't be able to mount a very effective attack. You had all these problems with target intelligence. You had, you know, all your own vulnerability and so on, the absence of an effective air defense. These things now all mattered a great deal. If war broke out, we might well lose, all right? Soviets have the upper hand. They sense they have the upper hand. We know this from a variety of sources. We know what the Soviets are doing in 1950 to prepare for a showdown. We know what they're telling people in the East European satellites, because the satellite governments, you know, and you know all these countries in Eastern Europe, they're more thoroughly penetrated by American intelligence than the USSR itself ever was. Right? And so these people would be telling us these things about the Soviets saying, we're going to get ready for a big showdown. We're going to get ready for a war. Stalin himself tells Mao, you know, if a war is inevitable, let it happen now. Right? And then what happens is that the United States, shocked by all of this stuff, realizing that it made its big mistake in the late 40s and with its low military spending policy, you know, adopts this massive rearmament program. The key document there is called NSC 68/4 of December of 1950. You know, it's like a quadrupling of military spending. And it's going to have an extraordinary effect, because this is a time of very rapid technological change in the whole military area, especially in the nuclear area. You know, the coming into line during this period of thermonuclear weapons, you know, of atomic bombs light enough to be carried on Navy carrier-based attack aircraft. You know, and throughout the whole military sphere. As I say, this is the real beginnings of military computerization, military electronics in general, say, gets off the ground. But it takes a long time from the point where the decision to authorize this buildup is made, you know, getting the Congress to support it, you know, to vote the money, and then, you know, retooling all these factories, designing the sorts of weapons that would embody the very latest in military technology. it takes a much longer time to do that in this period than it took the United States to gear up for World War II, because the technology is much more complex. It's not simply a question like it was in 1942, shifting from the production of cars to the production of jeeps, from the production of trucks to the production of tanks, to the production of merchant vessels, to the production of naval vessels. You know, this takes a whole lot longer, but when those weapons start rolling off the assembly lines and being deployed to the forces in the field, and this is the very end of the Truman period, in late 1952, boy, the balance has been totally transformed, because the mere fact that there had been this technological revolution implied that what the Soviets had in terms of forces and being, all these large land armies they had in Europe, this is obsolescent. This is junk, right? The Americans are by late 52, they're really riding high, and in the early Eisenhower period, Eisenhower takes office as president, as you know, in January of 1953. The Americans just have the upper hand in the military sphere. Okay? And then there's this gradual, slow decline in the level of American nuclear superiority as the Soviets, you know, slowly, gradually build up their military power. To the point where, but the American nuclear edge lasts until September of 1963. It's amazing how you can date these things so accurately, I mean, with these documents. What do we mean by nuclear superiority? It means that if the United States goes first with nuclear weapons in a war, we would not have to suffer major damage in any counterattack that the Soviets would be able to mount. Damage could be kept to what was called nationally manageable proportions, not really heavy damage. And we had that ability straight through the summer of 1963 when it ended. Okay? That's the story of the military balance. It's like, and it's important to understand how the military balance was changing, because this has a dramatic effect on what's going on in the political sphere. Let me just stand back and tell you a little bit about this. When I realized this, this was like this big surprise to me, you know, because I was this like traditionally trained historian, a diplomatic historian. I just looked at foreign policy, never paid much attention to what was going on in the military sphere. Obviously, you kind of knew that different countries had different levels of military power, and that was an important element in the story. But these kinds of things, these effects resulting from these shifts in the distribution of power, normally I didn't pay much attention to this stuff at all. And when people said, well, you know, there's this big problem with windows of opportunity, windows of vulnerability. You ever hear these phrases? You know what it means? It means if we're strong now, but we're going to be weak later on. The balance is moving against us. So if there's a political problem, it's very much to our interest to have it out with the enemy now rather than later. This is exactly what Stalin told Mao in late 1950 when he was trying to convince him to move against the Americans in Korea. He says, if war is inevitable, let it happen now. You know, we have the upper hand now. We're going to lose it in the future. Right? We have a window of opportunity. They have a window of vulnerability, you know. And the argument that you find in the political science literature, you know, arguments made by leading international relations theorists was to the effect that all this window stuff, all this business about preventive war, if war is inevitable, we have the upper hand now, we're going to lose it in the future, let's have it out now, right? That preventive war sort of argument. The political scientists argue this stuff counts for an awful lot. It's a very important part of the story. And for years, when I first was exposed to this stuff, I thought these people were crazy. And I thought that I would be able to basically show how wrong they were by looking at the whole story of the military balance in the early Cold War period, because it was changing quite dramatically, obviously. The loss of the American nuclear monopoly, then with the thermonuclear revolution, the big American buildup, and so on. you know, what sort of political effect did this have? You know, was it, you know, front and center, or was it kind of in the kind of deep background? And it turned out it was a whole, you know, and I was fully expecting to show that, no, it wasn't very important. You know, lo and behold, I was wrong, you know? You look at the documents, it's as clear as can be that those kinds of issues were of absolutely fundamental importance for all these people at the time, you know? It's like, we're really worried in 1950-51 that the Soviets might bring matters to a head. I mean, the whole body of thinking begins in the spring of 1950, when people look at these shifts in the military balance resulting from the breaking of the American nuclear monopoly, and they expect the Soviets to become increasingly aggressive. They don't know where the Soviets are going to make their next move, but they expect aggressiveness because the Soviets not only have the upper hand at this point, but they know that the Americans can't live with that, and the Americans will begin building up, and the Soviets have an interest in settling accounts before the balance totally shifts against them. We are quite scared about this stuff. And we expect this sort of Soviet behavior. It comes in 1950, mid-1950, with the Korean War, and especially in the fall of 1950 with the Chinese intervention in the Korean War, is much more serious than the initial North Korean attack, for the reasons I explained to you. Right? I said, well, this is the proof. This is the proof that they're taking advantage of what for them is a window of opportunity. They want to move before America builds up its power. And so there's a certain uneasiness about embarking on this major rearmament, lest it provoke the Soviets to bring matters to a head. Right? That's the context in which foreign policy is worked out during this whole period. What's the American response? Are we going to be deterred? Are we going to be so scared of provoking the enemy by embarking on a buildup that we just don't want to do it? Quite the contrary. Dean Acheson, American Secretary of State, again, the real maker of American foreign policy during the second Truman administration, 1949 to January 1953, Acheson is a very hawkish individual. You know, it's like, we are going to build up our power, period. Right? Well, it might lead to a war in Europe. We don't care. Because the important thing is the survival of the United States. To me, this is somewhat shocking. I don't know how you guys feel about it, but this is from a comment made by Paul Nitzer, who's head of the policy planning staff at the State Department under Acheson. It was kind of Acheson's alter ego. He said at the time, he says, The primary goal was the preservation of the United States and the continuation of a, quote, salutary world environment. The avoidance of war was of secondary importance. Even if war were to destroy the world as we know it today, still the U.S. must win that war decisively. He again stresses the point that the preservation of the U.S. was the overriding goal, not the fate of our allies. What's important here? Acheson moves ahead, not just with U.S. rearmament or with supporting, through our military assistance program, the rearmament efforts of European allies like Britain and France. He also wants to move ahead with German rearmament. And he meets with his British and French counterparts in the New York Conference in September of 1950, and he just lays down the law to them. You want American protection, you have to go along with our plan to rearm Germany. What's the attitude of the Europeans? We know that Western Germany is going to have to be rearmed sooner or later. It's part and parcel of our policy of integrating West Germany into the Western world, integrating Western power into the Western defense system, but now is not the time. The Soviets are poised on the brink. for these reasons having to do with the shift in military balance. We know what that they're preparing for a showdown. I should say, how do we know these kind of things? In Germany, there's no hermetic separation between the two parts of Germany. You go to the city of Berlin, you go in East Berlin, you can still take the Berlin subway from East Berlin to West Berlin and get on a plane and go into West Germany. So a lot of East German army people have a kind of militarized police they call the army, which is their equivalent of the army. These people are defecting to the West and are basically telling, we're being trained for an attack on Western Germany. We're being prepared for war. Okay? And as I said, we have all these other sources. I mean, one of the things that really struck me was a CIA report to the effect of what the Soviets were doing in terms of preparations. They were taking liquid fuels and they were storing them in such a way that they couldn't be stored indefinitely. Because they were unstable stored in that way, but it increased their military readiness. It made it easier for them to, launch an attack. You know, there are a lot of little things like that that contributed to the sense of, you know, matters might be coming to a head, right? And the interesting thing here is this, despite this enormous pressure that Acheson places on the Europeans, his effort to get them to endorse the immediate rearming of Germany is blocked because they figure this is the thing that's going to tip the balance. The Soviets are poised on the brink as it is. We're scared to death of what might happen. And if we provoke the Soviets by doing the one thing that they're most afraid of in the long run, namely having to face a very strong West German state, then there's a very good chance that this would lead to war. Right? So the Europeans are able basically to this American policy. Not only that, but it has important effects in terms of the internal structure of the Western alliance. It causes, for example, this dramatic transformation in French thinking about Germany. You know, the traditional French view was that Germany is the enemy. And now there's the sense, you probably get the sense these people, the French people, you know, rubbing their eyes and saying, gee, you know, we and the Germans are in the same boat in strategic terms. You know, if this reckless American policy provokes a Soviet attack on Western Europe, it's not only West Germany that's going to be overrun, it's all of the continent that's going to be overrun. You know, maybe we should work together more with the Germans. You know, develop some sort of European, meaning continental West European, security identity, political identity, you know, build Europe, build a Europe totally independent of the United States. That's the last thing they want because they know that the defense of Western Europe has to rest ultimately on American power. But their feeling is that there has to be a better balance within the Western alliance, that the Americans can't be just absolutely predominant, and the Europeans are just American satellites. The Americans are pursuing a policy that really endangers the core interests of these West European countries. France and Germany should kind of come together and act as the nucleus of a West European counterweight to American military power within the Western alliance, right? Not to get rid of the Americans, but to have a better balance within the Western alliance so that the policy of the West as a whole would take into account the fundamental national interests of the Europeans. Right? So you have this beginning of this movement toward the creation of an integrated Europe, a united Europe, which is going to be an important element in our whole story. And this stuff really kind of gets off the ground in late 1950 as a reaction to what the Americans are doing. What else? How do the Europeans try and slow the Americans down? See? One of the things is the French come up with this plan. Do I have it here? The Pleven Plan? Yeah, December of 1950. Pleven was the French Minister of Defense. And this is a plan for a European army, an army composed of German contingents, French contingents, Dutch, Belgian, you know, the whole shebang in continental Western Europe. And this, the argument ran, was a way to kind of create an indigenous European counterweight to Soviet power on the continent of Europe without being directly reliant on the United States. They should be able to pull themselves together. And the Americans loved this kind of thing. This Pleven plan developed into a plan for what was called the European Defense Community. The Americans loved this kind of thing because we didn't want to have to carry the burden of the defense of Europe forever. We felt that these West European countries had the resources, the human resources, the economic resources, technological resources, if they would only come together, you know, to develop the sort of military force that could keep the Soviets at bay without a direct, permanent commitment of American power to the defense of Europe. These people, were capable of defending themselves. They should be encouraged to defend themselves, and so we wouldn't have to bear that burden, right? The United States during this period is not interested in being the great leader of the Western world, the great imperial power, you know, which is responsible for the defense of Western Europe. We don't want that burden. Yeah, sure, for the time being, we have to carry it because we have to provide this kind of umbrella that's going to protect Western Europe while the Europeans are coming together and building up their power. But eventually, we want these people to rely on themselves. And that whole strand of American thinking, it's an important part of the Western strategy, even in the 40s, late 40s. Marshall Plan, very much kind of rooted in that kind of thinking. Let these Western European countries put their stupid, silly national differences aside, you know, come together as a unit. You know, only in that way could they form a power mass capable of balancing the Soviets without, you know, direct American involvement. We push hard in that direction. So we like the Pleven Plan and the European Defense Community and so on. The French, as we now know, for them it was just a tactic, a device to slow the Americans down, you know, to kind of throw some sand in the wheels of the Americans. Right? So what's the problem with all these schemes from the French point of view? It's like a truly independent Europe without the Americans involved, a Europe based on France and Germany. Well, Germany's going to have to be treated as a full partner of France, West Germany, that is, right? And if West Germany has the same political rights as France, then what's going to keep West Germany down? What's going to keep West Germany from once again developing its power? They don't like the idea of a freestanding Europe. They want the Americans to stay in, right? And of course, once you start saying, well, we have to build a European army, it's like it raises all kinds of questions. Well, what's the connection between this European army and NATO? Who's going to command this thing? Are the Germans going to be able to build up the same sort of military power that Britain, France, and the United States were in principle able to build up? You know, is Germany military power is going to be constrained in any way? How are you going to guarantee the German power is kept limited? You know, that's in the military sphere. And then it's like, if you want to take Germany into to this Western bloc and it's part of this Western army, you have to treat Germany as an equal, not just in military terms, but also in political terms. And this means that you have to kind of do away with the occupation. But does that mean you're going to give Germany total political freedom, freedom to, you know, do whatever it wants on the world stage, build up its military power however it chooses, you know? So, or should there be constraints on German power? Well, you know, obviously you want to move away from the regime of the occupation statute to something else. But what is that something else going to be? And how is it going to be connected with all this military stuff, the European Defense Community, the NATO, you know, so, you know, the level of armament question, the right of the Western powers to base their forces in Germany, the, you know, preventing a future German government from you know, simply ordering them out, you know, all these kinds of issues. It's this huge, big ball of wax. They're all tightly interconnected with each other. And And it's going to take a very long time to sort these things out. Well, from the standpoint of France and Germany, that's all to the good. Right? Because they don't want to simply oppose the Americans head on, because they don't want the Americans to abandon them. Say, well, yeah, we want to do this thing, but we've got to do it slowly. We've got to do it carefully. And so they're able, by setting off this very complex negotiating process, to keep the Americans from moving ahead point blank with the one measure that could provoke a Soviet preventive attack, namely the simple rearmament of West Germany, the recreation of a German national army. Right? So they block it. And so you have this whole process going through 1951, 52, 53, and then finally climaxing in 1954. Okay. There's a whole set of agreements that are reached in 1952 relating to the EDC, European Defense Community, and the political regime called the contractual regime that would replace the regime established by the occupation statute, a regime that specified all these different rights that the Western Allies would continue to have in West Germany. All right. And now the French, who were the initial proponents of all of this with the Pleven Plan in December of 1950, they're not willing to take yes for an answer, is the expression. The French parliament refuses to ratify all of these agreements that have been worked out. And so they spend, you know, the rest of 52, and then through 53, and first half of 54, you know, just trying to make all these changes to see if they could change the system so it becomes palatable to the French, you know, because basically anything like this European army that would be set up by the EDC, you know, to keep Germany from having freedom of action, you have to create this institutional framework which integrates Germany into some sort of supranational army, prevents the formation of a German national army. But you can't claim more rights for yourself than you're willing to give the Germans. So if you want to limit German freedom of action that way, you also have to limit your own freedom of action. Right? You have to say France can no longer have a national army because we don't want Germany to have a national army. But that's something that a lot of people in France find very hard to accept. No longer have any independent control of our own destiny, no longer able to create a national army, and if we create this European army, who's going to even control this sort of thing? There's no political Europe, political integration of Europe, a true United States of Europe, common president or whatever, to kind of make the political decisions about how that military force should be used. So in the absence of a true political control of this European army, who's going to control it? Well, it's going to be the Americans. In fact, the American military commander in Europe, called SACEUR, Supreme Allied Commander in Europe. None of this stuff is very palatable for the French, so this stuff just kind of grinds on. But the important thing to note is that by mid and late 1952, the Western buildup has reached this point where it's totally out of the question that the Soviets could resort to war to challenge whatever the West is doing. They now have, for military reasons, a totally free hand to shape whatever sort of relationship they want with Germany and in the military sphere. All right? So here's what happens. The Truman administration, their great hope in the early period was for freestanding Europe so that the Americans wouldn't have to carry the burden of defending Western Europe. But Acheson gives up on that in like July and August of 1951. Right? And the Americans reluctantly say, well, I guess we're stuck. I guess there's no purely European solution to the European security problem. If we want to kind of keep the Soviets at bay, we're going to have to stay involved. Incidentally, you can look at this whole problem in security dilemma terms. absent the American involvement, there's a very sharp security dilemma between Germany and Russia. To protect itself from Russian power, Germany has to build up its own military power. But that would inevitably be viewed by the Russians as a threat, right? And they would respond to that by increasing the threat level against Germany, increasing the pressure on Germany to build up its power yet further. The only solution to that sort of security dilemma problem is to have the Americans come in. You know, we don't care that much about German unification or anything like that. We can act as a cushion, you know, in effect, protecting Russia and Germany from each other. It's like, as long as the Americans are in, Germany can be kept non-nuclear. We tell the Soviets, look, you don't have to worry about Germany. German power is going to be contained within the structure dominated by the United States. You know, and you basically tell the Germans, look, you don't have to provoke the Soviets, you don't have to go nuclear, because we're going to protect you. You know, it blunts the edge of the security dilemma. Or kind of, you could look at it in those terms. Okay, so that's what we come under Acheson in mid-1951 reluctantly to the conclusion that we're stuck. We don't like it. We have no choice but to remain in Europe. It's like, so here it's not Imperial America insisting on composing its control on Western Europe, and Western Europe being the main satrapy in the great American Empire. We're not cut from that cloth in those days. We're sucked into this stuff, you know, kind of reluctantly. Okay. All of this changes overnight in January 1953. What happens in January 1953? Truman administration is out. The Eisenhower administration is in. And Eisenhower had very clear sense for what he wanted. You know, Eisenhower is the great leader of the Western forces in Europe during World War II. He's kind of called back during the crisis period in 1950 and is made the NATO commander, first NATO commander, and he has a kind of clear concept. These Europeans can defend themselves. They should be made to defend themselves. It shouldn't be America's job to do that forever. He has his heart set on the EDC, although as a military man, he knows that it's like deeply defective. Wants to move ahead. Okay. So what happens then? August of 1954, all of these problems just kind of come to a head. The French have been dragging their feet on ratification. There's a new government in France headed by Pierre Mendès-France. Mendès-France has just said we can't just proceed along these lines forever. We need clarity here. So he allows the EDC to be presented to the French Chamber of Deputies for vote. It votes it down. That's the end of the EDC. You know, Eisenhower and Secretary of State Dulles are furious. But everyone recognizes you got to put something else in place. And they put a whole system in place. In October of 1954, this is the system of the Paris Accords. Extremely important part of this whole story. Paris Accords is the equivalent of the Great Settlement. It's the Great Settlement between West Germany and the Western powers, and it's the equivalent in importance to the Treaty of Versailles after World War I. Okay, what do the Paris Accords provide for? On the military side, Germany is going to have a national army, but that army is going to be integrated into NATO. What does that mean? It means that the NATO authorities, an American general basically controls NATO, Zakur, is going to decide where those German forces are going to be deployed. The whole logistical system, the supply lines for these German forces would be under NATO control. It would be based in the rear areas, which is, say, France, Holland, Belgium, right? The idea is Germany cannot move independently as long as she's integrated in this NATO system, okay? You could deal with the German National Army, no problem, because that army can't, you know, be used independently. We strengthen NATO's powers in that way. It keeps Germany's freedom of action limited. And we don't allow the Germans to develop nuclear weapons. An important part of the 1954 arrangements, right? As long as Germany can't go nuclear, she's dependent on the Western powers for protection. You don't have to worry about Germany. She's dependent on us. She's forced to follow our lead on political terms. On the political side, Germany is given, in a term of art, the full sovereignty of a full authority of a sovereign power over her own internal affairs. But basically, German sovereignty is limited in major ways. There are these things called the reserved rights that the Allied powers reserve for themselves as part of this deal with Germany. What are the reserved rights? The Germans can't kick British, American, and French forces out of their territory. We're there by right. We can use German territory at our discretion as a springboard for military action against the East. The Germans can't negotiate with the Soviets without us for the reunification of their own country. And also, in extreme cases, our forces in Germany have the right to intervene in German internal affairs if the democratic order in Germany is threatened, either by the communists or by the some sort of neo-Nazi movement, right? We're not going to allow Germany to go, right? West Germany is basically being kept on a leash, semi-sovereign state, right? All this is extremely important. Why? Because it lays the basis for a stable international order in principle. Because this is something the Soviets can live with, right? As long as German power is limited, as long as Germany is dependent on the three Western powers for protection, Germany can't pursue a revisionist policy because neither the Americans, nor the British, nor the French want to go to a war for the sake of the reunification of Germany. The Soviets know that. They're comfortable with a system which limits German power in that way and forces Germany to accept the status quo. The Germans, for their own part, they can also live with this. Right? Why? For a variety of reasons. The main thing is integrates them into the Western system and thus provides them with a degree of security against the Soviet threat. They're protected. Plus, becoming part of the West is a kind of form of moral rehabilitation after what they had done during the Nazi period. Now, these things are very important. There are juridical reasons, reasons having to do with Berlin, why they're willing to accept these constraints on their power. They don't want full sovereignty, because full sovereignty means the Federal Republic of Germany, that's it. It's a definitive solution. They prefer something that's more provisional. You know, and they can accept it. They don't like it. There are various aspects of it they're not too comfortable with. But, I mean, the German Chancellor Adenauer himself, he doesn't want Germany to have too great freedom of action because he doesn't even trust his own people. Germans can't accept this, right? But for the system to work, the Americans also have to be willing to go along with it. And this turns out to be the one great fly in the ointment. Right? You know, you can't limit German power in that way unless Germany is protected. And Germany can only be protected if the Americans are in. But if the Americans want to get out and they insist that the Europeans defend themselves, then what's going to happen to all these constraints on German power? The whole thing is going to go down the tubes. Right? And as I say, this turns out to be the most problematic element in this whole equation. Because Eisenhower doesn't want America to stay in Europe forever. He wants the Europeans to defend themselves. And this is going to have all sorts of implications. And this explains why this third great chance for peace, after 1945 with Potsdam, 1949 with the formal division of Europe into blocks, now 1954, the system of the Paris Accord, why this third great chance for peace doesn't work. And we know it doesn't work because just a few years later, the world moves into another great period of crisis, the second great period of crisis in the Cold War. And this is the crisis that begins with the Soviet ultimatum on Berlin of November of 1958. So that's what I'll be talking next time. Now what I'm going to do is, in terms of the giving back of the exams, I'm going to be putting them in alphabetical order from your last name, from the A's on that side down to the Z's on this side. Ugh. Okay, what do we got here? Oh, I should also tell you that what you're going to find in here is a number grade on the top right of the first page inside the blue book, not on the cover of the blue book. And you'll see kind of in many cases the reader's initial grade, and then if I had to change that, it's crossed out with the grade that I put in. Then you go into the course website, and on the home page of the course website, it gives you a conversion table telling you what your number grade converts into in terms of letter grades. Okay.